The Market Musings Podcast with Fairbairn and Russell.
Okay, thanks Mark for having me.
No problem. Yeah. So welcome to the Market Musings podcast here. I'm with Alexander Stahl from Brugg Graben, which is a resource investor in commodities, stock pickers, maximizing returns, minimizing risk. So welcome, Alexander. How are you?
Thanks. Nice. Thanks for having me. It's very nice to be here.
No, it's good to be talking to you. And I want to get into your background and what the company's about. But before we get into that, I think it's quite a good idea to talk a little bit about the past 3 weeks. We were supposed to do this podcast about 2 weeks ago, but we did have a conversation and it was quite hectic. Things were going on. We decided to push it back due to the turmoil that was unfolding. So let me get your opinion on this current situation and this current crash. Is it the burst of the tech bubble? Are we seeing mass liquidations going on, or what is this, a healthy correction or something more serious?
Mark, we never know these things exactly, but I think at the moment the evidence is piling up that what I would call has started as a orderly rotation out of what I would call long duration assets and into what I will call cyclical assets has begun in earnest 18 months ago. It's in an early stage still, but all of that has been triggered by what we call inflation. And inflation, we haven't really seen in earnest for 30 years, maybe even longer than that, depending on how we define it. But at the moment, we are in an 8.5% inflation environment for the US. In Europe, that's probably a higher average. You know, if you go to Eastern Europe, that looks more like 15%. And that changes everything. And that changes not just everything for the ordinary people on the street, but it also changes everything how you allocate capital.
Yeah. I mean, some people will say that inflation has peaked now. What's your opinion on inflation?
Yeah, what I call the team transitory. I think when we look at peak, and by that mean it may not go that much higher from here, maybe 0.5% higher, the worst is over.
Okay.
And from here, we ease off a little bit. Then I would agree with that statement. I would be surprised if inflation goes another 3-4% higher from here in the US. That would be very hard to explain.
Okay.
But if people mean we're not going to have inflation, you know, come July 2023, I would strongly disagree. Or if they mean by not having inflation going back to 2% by the end of the year, that I wouldn't see. I think it's probably going to be elevated for a longer time to come. I would argue we're in a structural shift for inflation, probably for years to come.
For years to come. Okay. Well, you said about a shift from long duration into cyclical. What do you mean by that then? What are long duration assets?
Yes, that's an important question. I mean, for some reason, the market perceives, if we stick with technology, the market perceives technology intensive businesses as such that disrupt and that do something new, and therefore they can in the long term compete better than others and have long-term earnings profiles and have a long-term future, while cyclicals are usually considered to be companies that have a good or a bad year and they are not growing. And therefore the market, let's take Amazon, looks at Amazon as this wonderful business as it is and says, we're gonna value the business and its free cash flow over a period of 30, 40, 50 years. And then we discount it back, those cash flows from here, and that gives us a market value. And I think that has certainly worked in the last 10 years while inflation was low. But now that inflation goes up, what it really means is that this discount rate that people are using, which usually is called the US Treasury 10-year, which at the moment is near 3% or around 3% fluctuating, is actually, and a moment ago was at 1%, is actually too low in relation to inflation. Mm-hmm. And if that discount rate, or call it the risk-free rate, has to go up, that changes everything about your discounted free cash flow model. Mm-hmm. So you can take, say, Amazon free cash flows and say, let them be $60 billion for the next 30 years, which is a big assumption, because you make a big statement about the competitiveness over 30 years of Amazon. But let's assume that's true, and then you discount it, and you use once the risk-free rate of, say, 2%, and the next moment you change it and make it 4%, that probably takes off about 35% of the, depending on how much premium we give to the risk-free rate, it takes probably out 35 to 40% of the value of that business. And so that's a long duration asset, a technology asset that is valued that way, and that gets revalued by the market as inflation pushes up the risk-free rate, meaning the US Treasury 10-year. And that's also obviously even in a purer form true for bonds, which are exactly the same. They have fixed coupon. But if that if the payout ratio of that bond changes with the fluctuation of the yield, then obviously everything changes too. And so bonds equities that are valued over a long period of time will get re-rated. Okay. While those cyclical stocks that, some of them tend to look only at 2, 3, 4 years in the future, they usually are better investments.
Mm. Okay.
And then we also obviously have to ask, so what brings in, what does inflation do? Where does it come from? And then often it comes from businesses, or call it commodities, that are run by businesses that are by nature cyclical, such as oil.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, we'll talk about the cyclical nature of these sectors in a little bit, but to summarize, you'd think then this is more than just the COVID bubble, the crypto bubble, the tech bubble, all the quantitative easing that happened in the last 2 years, all these new investors that inflated the bubble there in the indices. This is more than just that correcting. Yeah. This is a fundamental shift.
Absolutely. I would say everything you just explained has made the effect bigger.
Bigger, yeah.
Okay. And therefore, the correction bigger to the downside.
Yeah.
But it will continue for the reasons I explained. But
yeah.
Of course, quantitative easing and this amount of money that has stimulated the market has, for some of these businesses, created better earnings and therefore increased the effect in the short term to the upside and now to the downside.
And now to the downside, yeah. And we'll be in this period, if you like, for a little while longer, do you think, before we start to see the commodities stocks coming out the other end and starting to do well, and the shift going into that? You think there's still a fair bit more pain to go?
I would argue the rotation has just begun.
It's just begun.
Has just begun. I think this is a long process, not the least because of what we observe in the geopolitical landscape, where we more or less have lost Russia as a reliable commodity provider. And Russia is a commodity powerhouse, while a small economy or a commodities powerhouse. And I think Russia has lost trust with its clients, the core client being Europe. And people want to get off the hook of Russia, so to speak, and they will. Mm. Politicians have to. And on that basis, we have a structural shift in how commodities flow and how many of them are available. Mm. And we can go through each of them, but I think this is a long-term structural shift that we see that is on top of other shifts that we saw, the gain shift that puts capital to one place but not the other.
Yeah,
we get back to that, but that's another, call it tectonic shift, that you observe only in once in a lifetime.
So it's a long-term reallocation of capital and out of, okay. So more short-term blood on the streets, let's say, for many investors. The strength in the dollar and what I know we spoke 2 weeks ago and you said you'd almost all gone to cash.
Yeah, we still have a good allocation in oil, but we have now a large allocation in cash because what we say at the moment, so for 2 years, we talked about this rotation coming and it rewarded us well, and we explained inflation coming and it rewarded us well. So we had the right framework in mind and we were well positioned for that. But at the moment, we're taking a more cautious stance because we fear this could go disorderly. And the main reason for it to go disorderly, I think, is the reaction of policymakers. I think they will make the crisis bigger because they always react late to what the problem at hand is, and they will emphasize the problems rather than making them smaller. They will increase them. And that's why I think there could be what I call a disorderly period in the market. And then everything gets sold. Then there is no rotation. Then there is just, what can I sell?
Yeah, and what can I sell? Not what I want to sell either.
Not what I want to sell. What exactly. I can sell.
What I can sell. Yeah. And what are we thinking timeline wise? 3 quarters.
At least, I think this is at least until Q1 2023. But we have to take it a bit by the quarter. Our now casting for the macro process looks ahead and can make some statements into Q1. But not thereafter. Okay. And I think that after that, the information becomes very unreliable. Okay. So it's a quarter-to-quarter process where you have to make judgments, but I'd be surprised if this takes less than 12 months. I wouldn't be surprised if it's more like the 70s where it takes 18 months. But that doesn't mean 18 months of disorderly markets, right? Maybe we have an air pocket somewhere in October for some reason. It's often the October that creates those incredible market events, and I wouldn't be surprised to see that.
Okay. Well, thank you for that. Before we talk any further, let's just talk a bit about your background then and your company as well. Can you give us, I know you said before it's difficult to give an elevator pitch, but maybe talk briefly about your background and what's led you to where you are now and what you do at the company.
Yeah. Look, I studied economies in Switzerland and St. Gallen, and then I went into investment banking and for 5 years, as we often do, by the way, in the UK. Worked for a company called Warburg at the time, and that was a boutique corporate finance shop that was run by very, very talented people. And what I like to say, in those 5 years, I really, for the first time, learned how to work. Because you had to deliver, it were long days, and timelines mattered. And so that was a good ground education. But then I quickly felt I can do it on my own. I want to touch companies, not just talk about them or do Excel sheets about them. And so I went twice operational, where I ran smaller practices, smaller companies as CFO and also as CEO or chief operating officer. And I had about 8 years of that. And in between, I was active in private equity, which is kind of the intersect, right? Where you have to understand companies operationally, but also at the end of the day, you're an investor. And so I was 10 years in a company called Babcock & Brown, which was a, call it resource investor in a sense, but it would take a bit longer to explain it, but there was a large emphasis at the company. And that's, I think, where also I created what I called some circle of competence with regard to industries, which is important when you invest, because at the end of the day, good investing comes down to understanding the industry, not just the company as well. Mm-hmm. And to see those cycles and to adapt to them and be realistic about them. And I think that's where a good foundation was created for what we do today. And in 2014, I more or less decided to do it on my own with the capital that I was able to accumulate over my career. And since then, Burggraben is my holding company, which I own 100%, and where we allocate capital with. And then we have some over the years, from our own network, we have what we call managed accounts, clients, call it friends, that know me well, that have probably worked with me in the past and have trust in my, analysis and the depth of it, and we took them along in our journey. Mm-hmm. And for those we have, call it, obviously we get rewarded when we work well for them. But that's not the majority of what we do. I mean, the majority is our own capital. And as I said to you, we are actually not looking for clients, because I think to have a happy relationship with a client in what you do here in markets, it needs to have, it's kind of a marriage. It's not a girlfriend.
Yeah, indeed.
And if they just come in quickly, and even if it's a lot of money, and you don't understand exactly who they are, and they don't understand exactly what your model is, then there is a chance that exactly in the wrong moment they want to leave you.
Yeah, which
and then they remind you as being someone who lost the money, or you just have to sell in order to hand back the money in a moment when you don't want that.
Indeed, and it's purely commodities focused. Is that right?
No, we are generalists, but it's definitely, we made commodities, oil, gas, copper, miners, I would say, many, many of those commodities, metals, base metals, but also, some of the soft commodities like wheat, corn, and so on. We made those our circle of competence, but we are definitely, we've looked at other sectors too, and spend a lot of time there too, real estate and industrial companies and so on. We just try to go to places where we have a lot of similar companies so we can stock pick.
Okay.
And take the oil sector, that's a beautiful sector for that, because you probably have, I don't know exactly, but I'd say you have 3,000 companies at least listed. So that's a perfect place where you can apply your knowledge, specific knowledge that you had only to acquire once. And now you can leverage it over many other companies. If you go in the weeds of industrial companies, very few of them are the same. Mm. And then there is very little leverage to your knowledge. And that's why I like to stick around those kind of industries where I can look at many copper players, or many gas companies, or many fertilizer companies, and so on, rather than just Siemens, which you have to analyze once and you can never apply to anything else.
Indeed. So research is a key part of what you do. And I know when we spoke before, you talked about, you modeled everything. You modeled all the mines, didn't you? You said, yeah. So
yes, we literally take this extremely seriously. And then if we go about the sector, we more or less look at everything there is. Meaning, take copper. We didn't find one, or maybe we don't have information for one, because it's in, call it, Pakistan, and you just don't. Or in Iran is a good example where we can only get very, very little information out there, not listed. But in general, we try to model out each miner there is in order to have a proper sector model then. Mm. Because that's where it starts. You need to understand the sector and see really who is doing what and why.
Indeed. So you've been doing this a while. You're older than me, so I guess you have probably seen a cycle or two. And from what I know about the sector, it's very cyclical. It does go in cycles. I wonder if I can try and get you to help me understand the cycles a bit more. Is it just a matter of it starts with low commodity prices, low exploration, low investment, until the point where demand means that money has to go into that sector, and then effectively the opposite happens. You then have overinvestment, over exploration, saturated market with commodities, oversupply, and it switches again. Is it as simple as that, or are there other driving factors?
It is as simple as that. It's absolutely that. It's what I will call a CapEx cycle.
Right. Okay. And typically,
from these industries, you know, the commodities send them price signals. So oil goes up to $100 or above, and then everyone says, "Well, there is obviously not enough oil." And then the industry starts to invest and brings out all this capital and looks for all these new fields out there. And then at some point they overdo it, and then they come all. You know, these projects have often long lead times. So for a while, you don't feel anything about the CapEx cycle, and then suddenly it hits all at once. And then there is, and then don't forget, many of these commodities are priced at the margin. So very little, the last barrel too much, prices more or less the entire sector. Or the last copper mine prices the entire sector that you have or don't have. And then, you know, very little can have a big impact on the commodity price, and then the commodity price comes down, and then these miners have overinvested, they have unhappy shareholders, and then the management changes, and then you go to the next cycle where everyone starts to say, okay, the return capital to shareholders, we have to stop having all these silly investments, because often in those hype cycles, when there is too much capital allocation, there are also a lot of bad projects that really don't deserve to be taken online.
Okay.
Now, that has been true for the last 40 years. I think what has changed and we have to see how it pans out in the next 5 years, is that we now have really underinvested for a long time, depending on which commodity. That goes back as far as 15 years now, where we are just stopped looking for either, you know, discoveries, or we have just focused on the existing mines and expanded them or fields. And we have more or less squeezed the lemon.
Mm.
And now most of the supply side in the commodities that we overview are hurting.
Mm-hmm.
So in a normalized world, not a full recession, but in a normalized world, we can literally not supply the market, and therefore have to draw on the inventories that we have built in the past. And then as you start to draw on those inventories more and more, commodity prices start to panic. And that's what we have seen a little bit in the last 12 months. People have realized for different commodities, something is going on there. But in my view, we have not even seen the beginning of that.
Mm. Mm-hmm. And typically, how long do these cycles last? And where would you say we are now? Because I interview a lot of mining commodities companies, and almost for the last few years, the general consensus has been this sector's in a low.
Yeah.
So, I mean, are we, would you agree we are nearing the end of that low? I mean, I think that's fair to say, based on the earlier conversation, that we are about to come out the other side. And how long could the cycle last, the bull run in commodities?
Long.
Long.
First of all, are we in a low? You refer to that as for the prices of the companies out there? Or
yes, I would say for the prices of the companies, yeah, the performance of junior explorers.
I think we have been at the low in June, July 2020. That was the low.
Okay.
So the COVID lockdowns created the lows for probably most of the commodity equities out there.
Okay.
And since they recovered, but they recovered, some a bit more, some a bit less, but still on a relatively low base. And that has to be viewed in from two perspectives. Number one, because the commodity prices are still rather low.
Yeah.
And so the recovery has been lowish from a commodity spot price perspective. And we would argue, well, and most of these commodity prices have to go much higher in order to now incentivize the companies to go out and find that commodity that we need in the future.
Mm-hmm. So you, by your explanation, then the low in 2020, so we are now at the start, the very early stages of seeing the upswing in mining exploration.
I would even argue we haven't even started there.
Okay.
So at the moment, I would say there is absolutely no shift in mindset at Glencore.
Okay.
Glencore probably has, I'm not privy to what they discuss in the board, but I would argue I see zero change in behavior in what the big mining companies or the big oil companies are doing. In fact, in some cases, especially for hydrocarbons, it's the other way around. They are under pressure not to invest.
Mm-hmm.
Although they should. Mm-hmm. But the green shift tells them to be very prudent, very careful, although that is changing a little bit, probably in the United States at the moment. But so we don't see in any stretch of the imagination a CapEx cycle that begins now.
Okay.
I would say we would have to come out first of this almost resistance to invest. And then the mindset change. And then it's kind of, let's invest enough to replace what we have. But that doesn't help to then probably find what we need on top in a world that has a population growth and that needs more of those commodities, maybe not where you and I live in Europe, but certainly so in those large population places like Asia, where they absolutely need more of it and not the same tomorrow. Yeah.
Okay. And in past cycles, then, has it just been the fact that the time is due? We've had the underinvestment and now it's time to shift into exploration again and effectively overinvestment? Or has there been sort of catalyst events around that time? And the reason I ask that is because the shift to the electric vehicle world, the shift to the green economy, flexible grid solutions using batteries, renewable energy, this calls for huge amounts of commodities, metals that are used in those products. So I just wonder, in the past, has there been a catalyst event like that, or could this be the perfect storm where we see the time is right, but also the shift in the way the world's going to be is also right to even boost it even further, to give a super cycle?
We will, without a doubt, go into a major super cycle for some of these commodities. I would call them the green metals.
The green metals, yeah.
What is, however, interesting is that we are not seeing it at all starting at the moment.
Okay.
At the company level, those that are supposed to do, where we are seeing it is, call it, at the car maker level. So clearly, in June 2021, Europe introduced what they call the climate law, Fit for 55. So we have to reduce carbon emissions, CO2 emissions, sorry, by 55% by 2030. Therefore, it has a lot of implications for a lot of industrial activity out there. So we want to revolutionize transport. We want to revolutionize how industrial processes work and so on and so forth. These are big, big projects. And there we see the shift. A very clear shift where the CEOs come out and say, look, this is our target to produce, Volkswagen Group says, by 2025, Audi, the car maker brand that one of the many they own, will only produce battery electric vehicles by 2025. New one. And Mercedes has a very similar, very concrete target and says by 2030, every Mercedes sold out there has to be battery electric. So there we see a big shift, a major shift, but no, we don't see any shift at the level of the miners that need to provide those metals from lithium to copper to nickel to cobalt.
Mm-hmm.
And many others, but those are the big, in order to, for those many battery companies that we see a lot of capital allocation at the moment, in order to be able to order all those metals. And there we see zero shift.
A once in a lifetime opportunity for commodity investors, would you say?
Yes.
Okay.
Without a doubt, unless there is a policy shift. Where, say, the EU in 2025 says, look, there has been so much fossilflation And now we also have what I call greenflation, because obviously the prices of these raw materials go up, and therefore the battery costs much more than people anticipated only 3 years ago, and so on. So that we have to be careful here. We are creating, we are risking, call it the social fabric of who we are and how we live together. We are risking poverty here. We have to be careful. But unless that comes, because it has to, because it's too much for the system, I would argue this is, I give you a number. So the you asked me about, have we seen it in the past? And we have in our lifetimes. And that's when China more or less started its industrial revolution, what I call the second industrial revolution, where they went from out of you know, central planning into a, call it a free economy, although they still have the CCP as a central plan node. But there is obviously a lot of free economic activity in China now for something like 30 years, more or less. And so in the 90s, they started at a very small level. I think they had about 1.5 trillion GDP. And they took that within 25 years, more or less, to $15 trillion GDP. And that process in itself created a super cycle for most commodities. Well, certainly for oil, certainly for gas, certainly for copper, certainly for nickel, for zinc, for all the base metals that I can think of, and to some extent also to the, for the soft commodity.
And what year was around this?
I would say it started in earnest 95 and went as long as, call it 2016.
Okay.
2015.
Okay.
Since then, I don't believe the numbers at all anymore, but for sure before that, they had the goals that they communicated. I don't think they have anything near the 4.5 or 5 they communicated at the moment. I will argue China right now is in contraction. But they don't show us that. But we see other indicators why it has to be there.
Yeah.
Okay. And so if that's true, we saw very clear behavior, demand behavior, for the need for those metals and hydrocarbons, and so that's a call it a 15 trillion shift each year, you know, each year in steps, and we can more or less study that. And what we are doing here is 6 to 7 times bigger that. Okay. So we are creating. Sorry, it's even more than that. We try to create for the this is dramatic, you know, for this green shift, we are trying to more or less create the investment of 6 United States, 20 trillion GDP is about 120 trillion we want to invest.
Wow.
So we have never in mankind seen anything like it, and we want to do that in the next 30 years, and a lot of that will happen in the next 10 and 15, and then so. So this is, I don't know what it all means and where it all takes us, but we haven't seen anything like this to come.
Okay.
If we are doing it as a human species.
Yeah, if we are doing it. I think we will, unless, like you say, something dramatic happens the other way that's really unpleasant. I think we are going to do it. And even if something dramatic bad happens the other way, I mean, you know, how do governments normally come out of this? By doing something like this, by, you know, in putting investment into infrastructure, into something, you know, significant. I think it's got to happen, and it's exciting for us in this space.
Absolutely. I think it's going to be one of the greatest times ever to live, but only if you embrace it, and only if you are part of it, and if you are one of these that are left over, then I think it's ever more painful.
Yeah, indeed. Indeed. Okay. Excellent. Excellent. Well, let me just talk a little bit about some of your specialty. I know you said your specialty was oil, gas, copper, and nickel as well. So let's just focus on these ones. I want to sort of get your feeling. You're a fundamentals guy. You don't do technical analysis. So what are the fundamentals telling us? I'm talking about metals prices and how they're looking that they are at the minute and how they've been performing. Inventories around the world, probably at all-time lows. Supply demand, you know, the supply side disruption we've seen and how that's affecting things. Just, I wonder if you can give me a bit of a snapshot from your point of view of what the fundamentals are telling us for the commodities that you mm-hmm. know.
Mm-hmm. Why don't we start with the green metals and then we can go over to the hydrocarbons, but it's the same picture for both. Just in some cases more dramatic, less dramatic. Mm-hmm. But let me start with the more, let us pick copper as the largest one of them, and then it's similar for zinc and it's similar for nickel. And then they all have their specialities because where they come from, where we find them, and so on. But if we stick with copper, to keep it simple, also for the audience and digestible and mm-hmm. memorable. So let's start. Why is copper important? A, because it's the best conductor we know and in the periodic system, other than silver, of course. But silver is so much more expensive that it cannot be applied at scale, nor probably found at scale. And then the second best, call it replacer, will be aluminium, which is an important base metal that we should keep in mind, larger than copper. But aluminium, while much lighter, doesn't have the same, has 70% less conductability, and therefore it's more brittle when you apply it in industrial applications. And therefore, it's not a very nice replacement. You know, if you go to ABB here in Zurich, one of the largest industrial companies in the world, Swiss group headquartered here in Zurich, and you go and see what, you know, the big trafos they do, and the big cables, massive industrial projects, the grid projects they have, and so they don't like aluminium very much, and only in very specific applications they use it for the grid, where the cable hangs for the rest of the life in the same way because it's light, but they would never use it for an underground. They don't like to use it for an underground cable for a link, call it between the UK and Norway, where it goes underwater because aluminium doesn't like water and so on. So how does the situation look for copper? Well, we need in total industrially 30 million tons of it, 10 about of that we recycle, and 20 million tons per year we need to what we call mine. So that refined copper, at the moment we find from, don't know exactly by heart, but I think 450 mines out there, and some of these mines, the largest 10, they are, you know, between 50 and 150 years old. That's pretty bad.
Yeah.
And many of them in Chile and aging. And the reason we use those mines still is because they were so prolific.
Mm.
And we haven't found similar deposits easily. We did a bit of that, but not easy by any stretch of the imagination. So first of all, when you look then at this situation, how it can go forward. So we extract a lot of those existing mines that we have, but we have not much of a pipeline to just simply replace what we extract at the moment. And then on top is what you explained nicely to your audience already, is that now we're going into this green shift and we therefore need more copper, not less. And then I couldn't explain you, at least not from our work, where that more could come from, because we don't see it. And then what is important for your audience to understand is that even if you and I today go to the DRC in Africa and say, ha, here is this wonderful deposit with a 4%, you know, copper contained in per ton in the metal that we in the rock that we find, let's get it done. Then you and I, if we are advised by the best industry, backed by the best sponsor, you know, I don't want to name names here, but some of the powerhouses out there from Australia, from Switzerland, or from the US, We would probably struggle to get that project online in 15 years.
Yeah.
Just when the best work on it.
Yeah.
And so if that's true, we are already late.
Yeah, exactly.
And there is nothing we can do about it too, except, you know, some kind of European, Chinese, American, call it agreement, where we go in into those places and say, look, this is now a matter of national security, and we have to make sure that all the problems mm-hmm. get resolved, all the red tape gets resolved, all the corruption gets resolved as quickly as possible. And then, you know, if this is kind of a war way of doing things, mm-hmm. Emergency kind of way of doing things, then maybe we can solve some of the gap mm-hmm. and that goes up between demand and supply, and we could solve that. And there are many quality researchers out there. We have our own, of course, that will confirm you those gaps and the numbers. You know, the number is then 3 million by 2030 or 5 or 6 million tons per annum, that the gap is, it doesn't matter. The commodity, the price of the commodity will go up, you know, unbelievably higher.
Yeah.
Because as the commodity feels, we're running out of inventory. The only mechanism we have to match supply and demand is for the price to go up.
Yeah.
Because that will take away some of the demand where we don't need it. So maybe we don't need a nice copper roof in Paris anymore. Yeah, in buildings, mm-hmm. you know, art deco kind of things, you know, maybe we don't need that.
Yeah.
And maybe we really make sure that we need less of it in buildings, and we, you know, we become better in recycling and so on. So that process needs a high price mm-hmm. for it to be refined. And now don't forget, Europe is already a recycling champion. Mm-hmm. China, not so much. Mm. The US probably much less as well. Mm-hmm. In fact, I know that in detail. And so they can improve there. But all these things need to happen, and they only happen if the price signal is there.
Indeed. So you're saying currently about 20 million tons of copper is mined a year?
Yeah.
And
21 at the moment.
21. Yeah. And most of it's coming from mines that are 50 to 100 years old. So they're already being depleted, and we know
the largest ones are very, very old. There is only one important large project at the moment that comes online, done by a gentleman called Robert Friedland, one of the great miners out there. And that's a project called Ivanhoe in the DRC, but that's the only one that matters. And then there were two interesting projects in Russia, and I guarantee you what, they're not going to happen.
They're not going to happen, no.
So the Rudokan project, which is a fantastic project, but Usmanov, that runs it, you know, is under sanctions, and Russia is under sanctions. And so how can all the technology that they need to buy in from the West can come in into that project? It's not going to happen. Then there's another one like that.
And what is the demand forecast to grow by then if we do go down this shift, this fundamental shift? Do you have that?
Well, I think the you know, for refined copper, the demand is probably going to be at least 30 million tons. Now, here is an important factor, which, you know, we as experts, we cannot really know these things. We can only do more and more and more work and reading and pay attention to. But what do I refer to? It's the Chinese real estate problem. So China uses at the moment by far the most copper in the world. But careful, right? It refines 50% of world copper, but some of that then gets exported of that refined copper, because copper doesn't come refined out of the mine. Obviously, so the raw material in form of copper or copper concentrate goes into China, 50% of that around the world, because obviously we in Europe want to not touch it anymore and this and that. So that's another problem there. But then it goes to China, and from there, either it goes into the local production and gets exported in the form of a washing machine to the UK, or it gets exported as the refined copper into places like Germany for the car manufacturers and so on. So that's the process today. And now China in the future, and the rest it used itself, and China in the future will use, in my view, just from an industrial, where they currently use copper. Again, copper is not consumed. Copper is used because it goes in a durable good that stays there for long. And by the way, copper can be recycled forever. It never loses its qualities. Mm-hmm. It's a fantastic thing that nature gave us. And that use, I think, will be much less in the real estate sector because China overbuilt. 22% of its GDP at the moment is related to the construction of housing. And that's an unsustainable number. If we would look at number, we would look at the numbers for the US, it would probably be 9%. I haven't looked up recently in the UK, similar, maybe a bit less than that and so on. So I think a sustainable number for China is half. And that, I think, takes out 1.5 million tons per annum of copper. That's our estimate. And okay. We cannot be scientific about that because we don't have access like most others to the precise data. Of course, we have a lot of data. It's not that easy in reality. And so our estimate is about 1.5 million tons gets taken out of that real estate bubble and can be redeployed into, call it, the green shift. Okay. But that doesn't move the needle enough, right?
No.
2025. Mm. So maybe we have a surplus for a short moment as the real estate bubble bursts. We have a perfect, call it a hard landing in China in 23. And the green shift is not yet, you know, the numbers of cars produced in Germany, in the UK, in the States are not that big yet. I call them, you know, I don't know, 5 million EVs, 6 million EVs. That would already be quite an achievement. And then we are fine. But then quickly, as the number goes and the battery electric vehicle numbers grow and all these other things, you know, don't forget windmills need a lot of copper and solar needs copper too. As those numbers quickly exponentially go, the copper demand goes exponentially at the same time. We don't have anything else where we can, in this amount, free up copper, and then we have the gap that opens, and then the price has definitely has to explode.
Yeah, yeah. So we're potentially short, about 10 million tons?
By 2030, we're probably short 5 or 6.
5 or 6, okay. Oh yeah, by 2030.
Well, you know, we are number people.
Yes.
And we constantly adapt to the numbers, but at the moment, the number would be around that as we see it from the information.
Yeah, okay. And a similar story for nickel. You don't need to go into as much detail, but
yes, it's exactly the same.
Exactly the same, yeah.
It's just even worse because nickel is a much larger, for the battery pack, nickel is a much larger part, but I give you the worst of all of them, that's lithium.
Yeah, okay.
Lithium gap is probably going to be the largest. It's really a Mickey Mouse sector so far because we didn't need that much lithium and we're going to need a lot of lithium and we're going to spend a lot of time in the future making sure we become the best lithium investors out there. And that's definitely what we want to be, you know, and I think that's going to be, you know, an enormous opportunity. By the way, the beauty of lithium is and that shouldn't come across wrongly to your audience, but of course in everything that you do in commodities, it's a global world, and there is below ground, call it geological risk, and then there is above ground, call it political risk. And so in an ideal world, people like us like to be in a place like Spain or the UK, just that you guys don't have that many commodities other than hydrocarbons, or in Australia or in the US or in Canada, rather than that we are in, you know, in some remote place in Africa. Mm. And lithium has a lot of potential in Australia, so that's a beauty there.
Okay.
While copper is much more an emerging market play, where Peru and Chile are the big two. And then the heart of Africa is another big part where it is. And that's just a more complicated investment process.
Okay.
Let me put it this way. It's more fun for BHP to do it than for me.
Yeah, of course. So then hydrocarbons then, what where are we seeing them? Of course, we have seen the prices of both natural gas and oil doing extremely well recently. And I mean, I think just recently just this week, the Chancellor in the UK has delivered a plan to effectively help people pay their energy bills in the United Kingdom.
And introduce the windfall tax for the industry.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, this is unheard of. Yet more helicopter money, perhaps. I don't know. But where do you see that going? Is that something that the prices are the high prices going to be short lived? Do you think?
No, I think there it could go even more bizarre.
Okay.
Higher than some of the green metals for a period, because I think that's where we also systematically underinvested. But it's much harder at the moment to rally the troops and reinvest.
Mm.
Not in Saudi Arabia or not in the places, call it where it's state-owned and state-direct, but in the, call it the world where the free market and free companies invest in it. I think it needs a shift in mentality for the investment to come. I would keep it as simple as this for your audience. Unless we invest in earnest in fossil fuels, the prices cannot go down much. They may go down in a very disorderly recession for a moment. That's the cyclical part of every commodity. But the structural part is such that we need a lot of investment to come for the commodity prices, for the fossil, for the hydrocarbon prices, whether it's oil or gas or coal, to calm down.
Okay.
And in some cases, they will then obviously not calm down, but they will actually go in overdrive. And we will probably see oil prices that we haven't seen ever. So we will go to new all-time highs. I'm not sure that's going to happen this summer, but I could see it absolutely come 2024. You know, let's say we digested the recession that is likely around the corner, and then we come out of that, and then still the investment landscape hasn't changed. We still don't know where it should come from, but inventories are now even lower. And we like to measure them in a five-year average, and we're already well below the five-year average for almost any country out there except China.
Mm.
And so as we run out of these commodities, the price will panic.
Yeah. Okay. And just quickly on gold, do you have how does gold fit into the picture? Maybe not your area of expertise, but...
No, we did a lot of work on gold. And in fact, we also modeled out most of what we wanted to model out.
Okay.
And it's a large sector, so it's a nice capital deployment sector. And we work with a gentleman who used to run a large gold mining company that helps us look in that sector, and so we feel very comfortable talking about gold. But gold is not a commodity, as we refer to it now, a base metal or a hydrocarbon that is needed for the daily activity of what we do.
Mm.
But gold is actually more a currency.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of the ultimate risk-free asset that one can own, especially in physical, in a physical way where you put it there and, you know, okay, yeah, this is now me playing safe.
Yeah.
And so why is it then a currency? Because the alternative for you to buy a bar of gold is for you to go out and buy the 10-year treasury, as we mentioned before. That's the risk-free kind of, the best kind of risk you can own while getting a return. And that at the moment offers you a return of 3% for 10 years. So you have to ask yourself, so why would I go and buy gold that offers me no return and in fact has some cost for storage, because you probably don't want to hold it at home, but you want to go to a bank or have a Tresor that you make sure that it's safe there. And so it has a negative yield, and that needs to compete with the 10-year treasury. Now it can, because we talked about inflation, and so you have to deduct from this nominal yield that you get from the treasury, you have to deduct the inflation, and you have to do that not for the spot, but for, call it, you know, a time-adjusted outlook of it, so we call them the break-evens. And if you take the 10-year yield and deduct the 10-year break-even, call it inflation rate, then you still have, I think at the moment, a slightly negative rate, so it can compete with gold. Gold is therefore can compete with that negative real, what we call the real yield. And in that sense, gold at the moment is call it almost at par at fair value where it stands at the moment. And some very fundamental people will say, yes, but it's this system hedge. It's this, you know, when everything breaks down, it's this one last resort that gives you. And we are a bit more careful on that. I think it's true, you know, especially for people that come out of countries that have seen large disruption, the system breakdown, like the Soviet Union, right? And they've seen like everything falls apart, nothing in value is left that you owned. And for those people, I completely understand the thinking. I think for functioning democracies, it's a little harder to make that case why you have to own gold in your Tresor. You know, when you live in Switzerland, where I would say, well, I mean, I don't see the state of Switzerland or its currency or its central bank break down at the moment. And, you know, the whole system fall apart. I find that a little bit of a stretch to make. I see why the system at the moment is tested and that there are many mistakes in the system. But you know, Japan showed that, you know, you can test the system and have a lot of debt for a long, long time to come. And while we have the virtues in the economy and with the people, and this economy is still rather very functional, you know, this is a relative world, right, compared to what, to anything else out there, right? Japan is a fiercely competitive place, so I find it a little hard to argue the gold breakdown case and say you need gold because soon everything collapses. But maybe someone would then say, no, let's go a step further. Why can the euro not collapse? And I want to have some insurance. Then I would argue, why don't you buy the Swiss franc or the dollar?
So good to have as part of a portfolio of just putting some.
I think it's fair to have it as part of a mix, but I think it's a little early to argue the breakdown.
The breakdown, yeah. But what about the miners though? Will they do well in this cycle, in this super cycle, the gold miners?
If they manage their cost well. But you know, this environment, we were just talking oil being higher and oil prices, everything that miners do because they need a lot of it. Not in the form of oil, but in the form of diesel or the transportation they do and the products they use, they are influenced a lot by oil because everything is kind of hydrocarbon-based or fossil fuel-based. Therefore, the costs are at the moment going up. That's not very good for the margin while gold stays the same. Mm-hmm. So I'm not at the moment invested in gold miners, but I hope at some point the signals come together and we have a very good process on that, and then we can go all in on some of the miners, those because they have some beautiful places to invest, and we're looking forward to that, but that's not where we see the opportunity right now.
Okay. Well, let's just finish on opportunities now that you mention it. We've talked a lot there, and we've talked about the super cycle. We've talked about this being a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity, potentially. Six United States being built, and, of course, the demand, if we do go down the green shift, which looks like we're going that way, the supply shortage is going to be huge. I also get the feeling that we have got a bit of time on this. It's not going to happen overnight. The shift is going to take a while. The reallocation of capital is going to take a little while. We mentioned there sort of quarter one next year, we might start to see things starting to shift properly and maybe disorderly up until that point, and then we start to get more clarity on things. So how do we find, we have time, let's say, how do we find the opportunity? How do investors, how do you find the compelling opportunities to make the most of this time? If you want to short the market and try and get that way, that's fine. If you want to just hold cash as well and wait to allocate it correctly, then that's a good approach. But how do we go about finding the compelling investment opportunities? Are there key metrics that you're looking for? Obviously, we're sticking with commodities, but are there some key metrics that you look for? And what kind of companies are you looking for? Do you go for the juniors or do you go for the more established companies? Give us some idea of how people can prepare for this to really capitalize.
So we like coming out of this, call it difficult recession period. I think, so what you do from here to there is you prepare mentally, accept that we are in an inflationary world and it's probably going to be an inflationary world as we come out of that recession. So therefore you want to be at the right place as you come out of it. So that would be my first advice. The second advice is, okay, so now you have time to prepare and so study those companies that you think are interesting and why. And then I would say, okay, which sectors do you want to go for? And so you definitely want to go for the base metals or the green metals, those that are needed in order to take out the CO2 that we currently emit more than we like in the future. And those metals are going to be the sweet spot. But I would put the hydrocarbons, and some people may like them more or less, but we look at these things from a very unemotional point of view. Mm-hmm. We like the oil and gas space as much as the base metals. So those is for sure going to be the sectors that we're going to look for the best opportunities. Now, to your second part of the question, you know, what are the reasons? I would say if you are a casual investor, someone that doesn't have that much time, has another job to do and so on, you want to go for the best names out of the blue chips.
Okay.
The Freeport McMoRans, the Glencores, the ExxonMobiles, the Chevrons, the whatever your taste, you go for those. Because they, while they are not going to have this incredible growth, they're going to have the they're going to have the earnings expansion, because the commodity prices, as we explained earlier, will have to go higher in order to incentivize A, the demand destruction, and B, finding those amounts that we need for the future. And so you benefit from that, number one. Number two, I would argue at the same time, the multiples will expand, because the multiples in the sector for the same amount of earning is still very depressed for the entire sector. More so in the fossil fuels, but also in the mining side, because people simply are still very cynical when it comes to these CapEx industries. They always think managers will misallocate. They will buy the wrong mines. They will do the wrong things with the capital. They waste our capital. So people are very cynical. You know, certainly the institutional community is very cynical about that still. And yet, I think we will see a much more disciplined way of allocating capital, and therefore people benefiting over proportionally, and the market opening up its heart to the sectors. That's number two. Then, if you really have time, and you really want to make alpha, and you really want to say, I want to be special, then you absolutely have to look at the smaller ones. We prefer the smaller producers with a project. We don't like the pure play. We don't dislike pure play discovery exploration plays, but they are just so much harder to get right.
Mm.
Because everyone is in love with what they have as an acreage. And they're all convinced it's going to be the holy grail that they find. And then that holy grail may be somewhere at 6,000 meters in Argentina and run by the best mining family out there, the Lundin family. And then I say, wow, this is really special. And they really have some of the best geologists. They're probably going to find it. And then it's the company's called Filio Mining. And wow, this is a large copper project. Okay, let's get invested there. But then I will have all these questions. So now what? You know, it's Argentina, which really doesn't have a mine running, or they can they pull it off? This is a hard one, right? And so I would try to avoid those, call it sirens, right? Unhealthy sirens where it's greed, that people just think, you know, I want to have a 10 bag. And say, be careful there, because if you have the wrong one, you're probably going to lose all your capital because the mine never takes off and you lose all your money. So I would avoid them and would say, why don't you go for call it a medium-sized company, you know, a billion, two in market cap, that already has a running mine or two and now has this beautiful project in, call it Australia, which has less above ground risk. And then you look at Copper Mountain in Canada and say, wow, they have this producing asset and they have a project here in Australia, and that's going to be where I place my money. And I think that's going to give people a lot of joy and benefit if they are patient. But you have to be aware that in resource investing, it's very volatile.
Yes.
It's not your average tech play, where Amazon moves maybe 2% down and then 2 or 3% up and so on, and it looks like an ice line. This is very choppy, and you have to kind of do your homework first, is our advice. And once you've done the homework, then you're at peace with volatility. If you haven't done the work, the price signal becomes, call it, instructs you, and you get insecure and you think, wow, what have I not seen? Why is the price down 10%? There is no reason other than the volatility of these sectors.
They're very volatile and very risky. Like you say, going for pure exploration, I think great management is one thing, but everyone who's half good at what they do can tell a good story. And like you say, are in love with their package that they have. And yeah, they might hit it big and you might win the lottery, but the chances of that are relatively low. But, so I think what you're saying is a producer with the blue sky as well.
Correct. Why not buy the combination? So you have the combination of the cash flow that is there, so they don't need to raise money.
Yeah.
In order to fund a project that never comes to fruition, which gives you the dilution and all the risk of that single stock. But if there is cash flow and they allocate some and they know what they are doing and they have proven so in the past, then you have a track record to base on, and then they're going to know how to bring on a new mine. Because just because a company is a company with a team there doesn't mean that team knows how to do everything in that specific mining process. There are fantastic geologists out there that know how to find stone. They know how to find deposits, but that has nothing to do with developing that deposit, bringing on a mine to fruition at a certain cost budget in a certain timetable. So those are two different processes, and they need the right teams in place. So I think the safest place for your audience out there is to look for those, call it mid-sized companies that have hopefully both.
And what market cap are we talking around mid-sized, did you say?
I would stick with something like between 800 to 2 billion, 800 million to 2 billion market size. And I think you'll find a lot. You'll find at least 5, 6, 7 good ideas, which hopefully have very little above ground risk.
Okay.
You never have it, by the way. Resource investing is not a game of perfect. You're always going to have a hair in the soup.
Yeah.
And you have to kind of understand how to weigh these risks, which death you want to die. Then you go for that and then you pick three of them. And then, on average, I think you're going to be rewarded.
Okay. And what about if you're a big risk taker? What if you want to go for the low market cap?
It's just not our game.
Game. Yeah.
No. Okay. Look, let's be frank. We invested, and that shouldn't come across wrong for your audience, but we invested hundreds of thousands of dollars into studies to understand deposits or reservoirs. And it's hard. I just don't recommend it.
Okay.
It needs specialists. It needs really a lot of knowledge, and the casual reading and management said it's just not going to work. It's not going to do the trick for you. There are lots of managers totally out, completely fine and at ease, and they have, in my view, zero integrity, but that's what they do. They go out and say, wow, this is what I have. I just posted one on Twitter yesterday and the day before. Completely unserious people. They talk about the big reservoir that they have, and they know how to term it, so people, and the casual reader thinks, or retail thinks, wow, this sounds big and it's going to be amazing. And it actually means, in terms of technical terms, the way we look at these things and we know what it means to commercialize all these things, so it means absolutely nothing what they say. Zero. And there are lots of guys out there, and they don't hesitate to sell and sell and sell and make, pump the stock. And then at some point they walk away, they have sold out, they had their option scheme and they made a lot of money for themselves. So there's a lot of that going on in resource, not just in tech and all other sectors and crypto and God knows where. That's in resource too. So I just don't think it's the right thing for people that don't do this for a job and have a good capital base to also have mistakes, that's what they should do. I think that if you're very casual, then you buy the best and you appreciate, call it the macro cycle that is to come that we explained, and you're going to benefit from that.
Okay.
And if you are a bit more time intensive and you you know, you've done it before and you like to do it and it's fun, then you go, I think, go for the meat place. And if you go for the exploration things, then I mean, you have to have some reason. I would then almost go like, who is the family backing it, right? And there are 5, 6, 7 big families out there that know what they are doing, and you need to know those names, and then you follow them. Mm-hmm. I would follow people more than I would follow just the noise of deposits.
The noise of deposits. Okay. Excellent. Well, thank you very much, Alexander Stahil, for your time today. That was fun. I enjoyed that a lot. I think we can do these podcasts again, maybe, and we can drill down a bit more and focus on commodity specific, but for a general...
We would love to. We can talk about this all day long. Come and see us if you're ever in Switzerland. We take you around. We don't have deposits, but we have beautiful mountains.
I am not far away. I'm in the Netherlands, so I'm on the continent, so I can travel. Yeah, so I might just do that. That might be a summer break. I can come and see you. But listen, thank you very much for your time today.
Thanks, Stephen. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to another podcast from Market Musings with Per Ben and Russell. Tune in next time.